Right. You want to be, you're doing it so you can make money. You're not doing it because you really want them to be better. And maybe you want them to be better because of that, right? But if you did really want them to be better, maybe you'd ask them how they would like to do that, because they probably come up with much more effective things that would take less time and be less expensive.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the People Processes podcast. I have with me Dr. Koretz. She is an amazing clinical psychologist, the founder of Azimuth Psychological. Her practice specializes in the unique mental health challenges from high performers and high achievers in high pressure careers. And her real claim to fame, or one of her key structural items that she deals with, is this idea of career enmeshment, which when I first read about was like, yeah, no, that sounds good. So Dr. Koretz, tell me, what is career enmeshment and why is it a bad thing?
So career enmeshment is basically when your career becomes your whole identity, then there's nothing else that comprises of your identity. And it's not always bad, but it's often problematic for people because, you know, similar to anything, putting all your eggs in one basket tends not to work out in the end. In some way, something happens. So at least a lot of the people that come to our practice, you know, they've worked really hard in their careers. They've checked all the boxes. They've done what they're supposed to do. And their company gets acquired and they get laid off. Or they don't make partner.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they don't have anything. They feel lost. It's more of an existential crisis because they don't know who they are. They don't know what they're supposed to do next. All of their self-worth and sort of validation has been based on this job that no longer exists. And it can really put people into a tailspin in terms of mental health issues and other kinds of related things like substance use. So that is the general broad...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think about, and not just out of negative occurrence either, you know, some of my longest term professional contacts, friends of mine, were entrepreneurial as well. They sold their companies, right? So they reached the top and they exited and, you know, got $20 million and then they crashed, right? Because it was the business was them and it's their baby, as they put it, and so that inability to separate really can have a major negative effect if that core identity goes away. As company owners though, or HR professionals, we almost go the other way though. It's our issue is not over engagement most of the time, it's under engagement. We think about trying to bring in a new hire and I mean it's right in the literature. Incorporate their identity into our business. It's what we want to do. And there are many books and processes written around the idea of taking somebody to turn them into a raving fan, where what kind of person are you? Oh, I'm a Harley Davidson person. This company that I work for or that I purchase from represents a core part of my identity. Would you say that that's on its face, bad? That we should be starting with the opposite, like helping them carve out an identity separate? Or what are your thoughts there?
Well, I think like anything else, you know, moderation is key, right? So it is important to get people excited about their job for a lot of reasons. You want to hire people who it's a good cultural fit. They are excited to do the work. They're excited to be there. It is part of who they are for one reason or another. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just when that's the only thing that they have, that's a problem. And ultimately that becomes problematic at work too. Because you have to manage people who are struggling in that way. And you're going to have to, as, you know, a manager or a business owner, you're going to have to, you know, ask people to do or not do certain things. And that all might be tied up in their own identity. And if it's the only thing that they have, then that becomes, there's a little pushback in that. So it's not necessarily bad or good. Just if there's a lot of gray space to live where you can be excited about your job and have it be part of you, but not have it be the only thing that you have.
As a HR professional or executive, would you recommend employers or companies systematically or like I can see a business owner or executive listening to this and go, you know, my top five guys or gals, my executive team, you know, they bleed people processes green, and that's what I want. Right. And I can see them waking up first thing thinking about work and going to bed last thing thinking about work. And they're my people because I know that I can, you know, if I'm thinking about it, they are too, right? And I wonder, is there an argument to be made that as an executive or as a leader in those organizations, you should be on the lookout for that as a negative behavior or a behavior that needs to be moderated? And would you think, I guess what I'd say is, in your experience, are there people who just thrive under that and do fine all their whole life? Or is it just like they do fine until it doesn't go fine and then it's all hell? Like, I don't know.
I would say most people don't ultimately do well if they only have one thing that their identity is resting upon, whether that's work or something else. Because eventually something happens, especially as you get older and you have other responsibilities, things to pay for, kids to take care of, elderly parents to take care of, things like that. You know, life gets really complicated. And so you'll run up against something that will challenge that. And so I don't necessarily think, again, that it's a bad or a good thing. I think, you know, having it be part of you is great. There are people that thrive in a high pressure environment, and they thrive in having work be part of a big part of their identity or most of their identity. And the example I always give is a physician. For, you know, a lot of doctors feel really committed to their work. They, you know, it's what they've worked so hard for such a long time. They believe in the cause. They're helping people. It's a greater good. You know, there's a lot of reasons why it's exciting for them. And that's fine. Like, a lot of times that's very helpful, right? It gets people to think more creatively about solutions that and different processes and different kinds of medication and how to treat different things in a creative way. You know, that would be an example of that's a really great thing. I might argue, though, that those people still, you know, have other parts of them as well that balance that out. Or, you know, there's a lot of ways to be a doctor, right? So if you are no longer working in a hospital, you can still practice a little bit on the, you know, depending on the obviously the specialty, but, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do that. Consulting, writing, you know, they can kind of keep that part of them in a lot of different ways. Whereas that's not always true for other jobs.
Okay. So if you're thinking about your, and I'm thinking about my company right now, right? I've got three directors and I love them all to death. And they bleed people processes. I'd talk one of them out of a neck tattoo for our swirl.
Right.
If I really care about them, your argument would be that it is best for me as a friend and leader, or best for them as a person, to make sure that we're leading by example and encouraging some degree an identity outside of work. That if you see the true, like, myopic focus into this, that there's really, you're courting disaster. It's a risk. It's a risk you should try to mitigate. You shouldn't look at outside identity as a negative, or even a, some people have it, some people don't, but actually something that maybe should be encouraged, especially among some of your key people.
I think it's also important to remember that there's sort of a time and a place for everything. So, you know, early stage startup is a lot different of a situation, right, than when you're 15 years in. You know, there are certain industries that are way more time sensitive than others. So, you know, you do want people who think about these things, who are smart and sharp, and they're on top of, you know, on top of it. But most of the time, I won't say all the time, most of the time, people burn out on that. And yeah. So it is a risk factor in some ways, if you think about it that way, where, you know, you want your you want your employees to be thriving, whether that's because you want to make more money, because you care about them, because you're trying to sell, you know, all the reasons. And so they have to be in their tip top shape, if you will. And part of that is, yeah, you need to just like take a hot second and stop coding, go, you know, talk to a person, have a shower, you know, like that kind of thing. Unless you're in kind of this, you know,
you can
early
burn it
state.
On the fence for a little while.
But... Yeah. Right. Exactly. Right. But
so
I think,
if I see... So if I see a employee or myself, but let's use an employee to make it a little less painful for me, who I can see they're burning out, right? They're, every day is a 12-hour day, and it doesn't need to be, right? They've incorporated the success of their in their position or in their role so heavily that they're overcommitting. And even me as the boss is like, take a step back a little bit, breathe a little bit. And if I tell them, hey, that you know, really, let's try to tighten your hours, let's develop those other things. But what I find is necessarily that they're not, it's not that there have been times in my life I've been this way too, where it's getting off work early doesn't make me any happier. I want to be it. I enjoy what I do so much that I'm, when I get off work, I think about work and I want to play with it. And I feel more engaged in that than in, I don't know, at the time I was younger, it was, you know, studying other things or building stuff or working on houses or playing video games. So I wanted to be at work.
Well, I think that can be a sign, though, that you're headed towards the sort of the identity piece. And again, I think it's a little tricky when you own a business, because a lot of times those things are mandatory. So I think if we're talking about the times where it's not necessarily mandatory, to your point, you know, I'm thinking about work, I want to do work. And it is, again, good to be excited about work. But if you're in a spot where nothing else brings you joy, I think that is definitely a warning sign that, you know, to take a step back and kind of start to reflect on who you are as a person, what your values are, how you want to spend your time, what do you want your legacy to be. And that will definitely include work, but it probably also needs to include some other things.
So what would be some of the steps to either encourage someone else to do, or one of our listeners who's maybe listening to this and going, I don't have to be at work 14 hours a day or think about work 14 hours a day. And yet I do. I realize this is all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. But I don't know how to step away. I feel like there's tons to do, and it's not that it'll explode if I don't, but I've got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. I get off work at 5:30, 6 o'clock. I don't sit down and eat dinner with them, read a book, play Bluey. I don't know. If that doesn't excite me, I'm just, God, don't judge me, you guys, okay? All right, whoever's listening to this. I do love my children and I do spend a lot of time with them. But if I feel that I'm over enmeshed in work, how do I start building out something other than that without a disaster? If the company would just go out of business or get sold, I have nothing else to do. All right, I'll go to the T-ball game more, I guess. But how do you do it intentionally?
That's a very good question. And I think there are several ways to do it, I would say. The first that I think is the easiest is, I think we think a lot about professional networks a lot of the time, but we kind of forget about our personal networks, because for a lot of the people that we're talking about, they haven't seen friends for a long time. Like, there's been a lot of excuses not to see friends. And, you know, some of them are legitimate, right? We're all busy, we have kids, we live far away, whatever. But, you know, it's much easier. It's easier than ever to be in touch with people. And so I say, you know, go back to those people. And even if you're, you know, not doing anything crazy, like maybe try to arrange a coffee, you know, if they have similar kids your age, get the families together, whatever. It doesn't actually matter. And it doesn't matter if it's small or short. But I think being with people that you've been, where you've known different parts of your life, will help you remember who you were during that time. And that helps people figure out, oh, yeah, I did used to like to do that. I forgot about that. Or I am a funny person. You know, I haven't had the opportunity to do these things because I've been doing other things. And right. So I think that that's a pretty easy way to do it, because you don't have to, you know, a lot of times people sort of complain, like, I don't have time for a hobby, or I don't want a hobby, or like, hobbies are too hard, or I don't live near this, or, you know, this, whatever. There's a lot of reasons to not do activities, I guess, which is fine. Always. You know, you don't. Yeah, right. And that's fine. Like, nobody's saying that you have to do that. And so this, I think, is an easier way for people to kind of more enjoy, in a very enjoyable, low stress, low commitment way, start to figure out like who they are, what they like again. So that's one angle in. I think another one that's a little trickier, we talk a lot about with people, is values and figuring out what your personal values actually are, because a lot of times people haven't really thought about it, or they've sort of assumed the value system around them, which ultimately isn't congruent with what's important to them. And so that's kind of where a lot of the dissonance comes as well. So figuring out how to sort out what is actually important to me, like, what do I, when I'm like on my deathbed, right? What do I want to have done? you know, what is important to me. And, you know, a lot of the things that are important to us can be boring or not fun sometimes, like work or, you know, sure. you know, kids or whatever, family, you know, and that's why having
Pretty
many baskets.
You watch the Bluey episode isn't always the most right. inspiring. Right.
Right, right. So, you know, that's why there have to be more baskets, because different things will be fun and not fun at different times. And that way you can pick and choose what, you know, and not feel stuck in one place. And that also helps people build distress tolerance when they also feel like they have at least they're on the right path and they kind of know what path that is. And, you know, for example, let's say someone starts to think a lot about their values and they realize community service is actually really important to them. And that's not something that they've done, I mean, for a long, long time, if ever. So the idea then isn't like, now I have to switch my job and do something in this like public sector industry. No, I mean, you can do that, but the idea is more like, okay, well, how do I incorporate that into my life, even if in small ways? Because a lot of small things together in aggregate make people feel very different, differently. And, you know, things kind of build on each other, because then if you're in a new place, you're with new people, you're meeting them, you know, they kind of bring other things out about you. They have opportunities that you wouldn't have had before, and kind of builds on itself. And so, you know, could you volunteer at the food pantry? Month, like the first Monday of the month, you know, for 3 hours. It doesn't have to be this grand gesture, which I think people like, you know, they want to feel like they've done something and let's turn the ship around.
That's
yeah,
right,
yeah. But in reality, like that's impossible most of the time. So I think values-based work is also incredibly important.
So kind of going back to the company design level, have you ever had experience with a client or a company or similar who did it well, who, I don't know, provided resources or provided this sort of life? I mean, to a degree, this is a broad way of saying work-life balance, though that means nothing. And there's such a broad... I like this idea better. It's not... this idea of making sure you're, when I think about, the first time I heard enmeshment was like among spouses or like codependencies or those sorts of things, right? This idea of your entire identity being subsumed. This is in parental literature and things like that as well, right? Where you've become enmeshed by being the mother to a three-year-old, or and that's all you can be and do all day. And there's a lot of that. But that actually destroys the relationship with the father or your prior friends and family. And it leads to you being a less successful mother in a lot of ways, right? Because you put your entire identity on a child. Maybe not the best idea. Now, so interestingly, maybe that same argument can be made for your career. Maybe it's not appropriate to put your entire identity into work. And I think that's a really interesting piece. When I think about, my job is to think in this term of company structures and what is successful and what is not, what helps the people inside the organization and the organization itself achieve its goals. Around 75% of who we work with is nonprofits or vision-based organizations. And they do subsume the identity. It's like, my name is Sally. I'm Sally from public radio, and I you know, I dress like Big Bird. Like, that's what I do. I am Big Bird, but for this city. And it's a big part of their identity. I'm trying to think about the structural side at the company level, how we could encourage this without it being, I don't know, silly, hand-wavy
yeah.
inspiration crap, you know?
I'm really anti-inspirational crap, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
I don't think work-life balance is a real thing. I think I'm very annoyed by the fact that people try to achieve that. I mean, if we had figured that out, if it was possible, we would have figured it out by now. And I think, you know, the goal is not to live in perfect balance with all these things and be like content and grounded all the time, because that's just not what life is. And so, which is sort of a tangent from what you're asking, but
well, and it's so interesting because I read your website. And I wonder about this, because I thought about this as someone who works with high achievers. Like, I read your website and it's like, this idea of at Azimuth, your psychologists and doctors who are working with these high achievers, to deal with this problem where maybe career breaks, and this is a huge part of it. Now, how do we rebuild? And I feel like that's such an antithesis idea to lots of high achievers. So it's interesting. I appreciate giving you the opportunity to be like, no, I understand that work has to happen. And like, I'm not saying, you know, you need to meditate and bang on the drum all day. And like,
right. Right. And that's why people come to us, actually, is because I think they appreciate that we do understand the nuances of a lot of their careers. We're not here to give you the advice that you already know, because they're all very smart about, yeah, like sleep more, eat better. You know, everybody knows that. And they would have done it if it was possible. And by possible, I mean logistically, but also emotionally or psychologically possible.
Right.
And right. So for us, the goal is to help people be in a place where they have a life that for them, whatever that looks like, they're happy a lot of the time, not all the time. They're grounded. They're doing values. They're living in accordance to their own values, and helping them build distress tolerance for the 1,000 annoying things that come along the way, as well as the really big life happenings, which are going to happen at some point, which are really scary and hard. Because if you're in the right place, then those things are much more, it's easier to manage them, and or it's easier to learn how to manage them. If you're not being like beaten down by a job that isn't working for you for some reason, or you're not burnt out or having an identity crisis because of the job piece, the shift in your job. So I think that's, you know, a lot of people who come to us have been to therapy before, and it was not helpful, because there isn't this appreciation that, you know, or understanding or kind of interest, like willingness to, like, you don't have to change your life to figure it out. Like, you have to change it a little bit, right? But you don't have to make these broad changes and quit your job and do yoga. Like, those are all nice things, but most people don't have the luxury of doing that, and they don't want to do that. Because that's
right.
Kind of the extreme in the other direction.
I worked real hard to become a doctor.
Interesting. Yeah. So how do you do that in a way that's more helpful to you? There's a lot of ways to do that. But to answer your question about systems, I think the problem with a lot of systems is that there is a lot of hand waving and sort of lip service, like, go ahead, take a mental health day, you know, but no one actually does it. And so you have to build a culture that's genuine, that includes things like taking care of yourself, whatever that means, because for some people that doesn't mean taking a mental health day, quote unquote. It means like going, an example, you know, going pheasant shooting in Wyoming with a friend from high school. You know, it can mean all kinds of stuff. And I guess that's a vacation day or whatever. But, you know, people need all kinds of things, and sometimes they don't know what they need. So they need to try other things out, or, you know, just accept an invitation to do something at a time that's pretty inconvenient for the company. And not to say that can happen all the time from a company perspective, but, you know, allowing people to live while they're also working a lot, because especially in our country, people work a lot. And I understand, as a business owner myself, that pull to like always want people to work more because you really like the people you've hired and they're really good at their jobs and you want to move things along. But, you know, it's very different to be an owner than it is to exist in a company. And people are not going to have the same goals as you are, even if they're really excited about the company, right? Because they didn't build it. And that's okay, right?
Right. That's the whole point. You got to be able to do it with people who aren't. Yeah.
Right. You want people. You don't want a bunch of entrepreneurs. You don't want to work with a bunch of entrepreneurs. It never goes well.
Two of them is all you can handle. And that's more than. Yeah.
Right. And so I think one way to do that that's very difficult and takes a lot of time, so nobody really wants to do it, is managing by relationship. And if you have a smaller company, it's easier to do this. But if you know anything about your employees, it really helps in general, because people don't want to feel like they're like a cog in the machine. People want to be recognized. And they want to be recognized for what they do contribute, because we're kind of in this system, like cultural system, of telling people when they're wrong and things are broken, but we never tell them when they did a great job. And seeing people for who they are, right? It's like, this person's husband's really sick, and so they need special accommodations, for example, or, you know, asking them how things are, like, or bringing them lasagna or whatever, you know, like, keep it work appropriate, of course. But, you know, people like to be seen. They need to be heard. They want to be part of a community. We're tribal. That's how we are. And so it works much better.
Yeah, be part of their identity, but sure. Maybe not all the way. I was
right.
I worked with a client once who did forced personal development.
Oh, no, don't do that. No.
Yeah, they hired people in, and they had, and I don't remember, but it was based on the miracle morning or some, I don't know. It was like, you had like your first 2 months at the company, you had to join this like personal development thing 3 times a week in the morning, keep a journal, share your work, so on and so forth. And if you completed the 60 days, he'd give you a $2,000 bonus. Okay. And then he had a program where if you would sign up for the program, and it was a 90-day personal development program, very similar, like three day a week meeting, work on your vision, your goals, work out, all the kind of stuff. And if you completed the 90 days, made all the meetings, did all the things, the journaling, the meditating, the running about, he would give you $4,000. But if you missed it, you lost $1,000. Actually deducted from your check. So you paid the $1,000, or he'd give you $4,000. And he did this to have a company of high performing achievers who had their life in order.
Did it
work?
What
he felt was his main way of giving back. Well, it did. It worked for him, because I think it works for 3% of the population. Right. If anything, if it could work for any, see, that's the problem with systems. They all work for somebody. So yes, you bring on 100 people, as long as you're willing to only keep 3 and do that for 5 years, you'll have your great team of 15 people. But you're going to have to go through a whole lot of people. So the more specific or crazy something is, the more effective it is on some people. Right. It's like a drug. It's like the more targeted and focused. The side effects are real bad for people who it doesn't fit, but it does cure something. And so he looked at it as building his tribe of crazies. And, you know, hey, it worked for him, actually. No, he became a publishing organization, around 40 employees now. And with 40 employees, they do the work of about 200 people, and they are very profitable and well paid. But I swear to you, their retention in the first 6 months is like...
Right.
Not great. Garbage.
So you can hear my negative reaction to this as you're talking.
I want it. Yeah. If you're listening, I thought you're crazy too.
So I get what you're saying, and I suppose that is a strategy, right? If you have time and money and you want to do that, it is a good way to sort people out. Ideally, your hiring process would have already done that, so that you wouldn't have to have this complicated money exchange and forced, you know, personal development. I mean, as a therapist, I have a very strong reaction to that, because you cannot make people change genuinely unless they're interested. And I suppose this program might make someone interested, or they become interested along the way. But most like prescribed programs that are implemented in the workplace are they are perhaps not necessarily well grounded in things that research shows work very well. Or if they are, you're still doing them in a context where there are these very complicated boundaries, right? So if you're doing journaling, let's say, how do you know that and like the company's paying for your journaling, how do you know that journal belongs to you? Does it belong to your boss? Is your boss going to look at that? Well, then I better not talk about these 3 things. So then how are you really developing yourself as a whole, you know? Or if you, like, as someone who does not like meditating, but appreciates the important aspects of it, and I do it anyway, they're still right. There are people that doesn't work for them. So maybe that's the dropout, right? And now, is that really why you want to cut someone, because they don't like meditating? Right. So I think things like that sound more like
an extreme example, but
I know. But that to me is the nod, right? That's the nod to it. And that's doing it for not them. It's doing it for you. And that's fine. That's okay too. But don't then say it's for them. Right. You want to be, you're doing it so you can make money. You're not doing it because you really want them to be better. And maybe you want them to be better because of that, right? But if you did really want them to be better, maybe you'd ask them how they would like to do that, because they probably would come up with much more effective things that would take less time and would be less expensive. And this is kind of how I feel about like forced company outings. Like,
sure. Yeah, a team building exercise.
Yeah, or like, or even holiday parties. Holiday parties are a whole, that was like a hot topic a couple months ago, you know? Like, yeah. A lot of people don't want to go to their company holiday party. And so I don't feel like they should be made to do that. You know, don't ask your employees to do other things unless they're asking, right? And
HR, I mean, if you require them to attend, it's paid time. Go ahead, continue.
I know, but like what, but you know, they're not required. Right, mm-hmm. But they are required.
I've got a manager meet a week from Monday. One of my managers, one of my newer managers, she's been manager for like since October. It's very new. We have 15 managers meeting up all in person. It's a big deal. We do it maybe 2 times a year, 3 times a year. She just had abdominal surgery. Like she just like literally like just got out of the hospital and home yesterday. Emergency. And she's not going to be back at work next Monday. And she's stressed, worried about not attending a manager meeting where we sit around and talk about our plans for next quarter and hang out, because it would be her, should be her second meeting. But it's not required. I give them a PTO day for going. Like it's in lieu of PTO, you can come do this and, you know, but you don't have to come. But the amount of stress or the peer pressure involved in going to it is quite high. But you don't find those to actually build psychological bonds, holiday parties, etc. Reasons to hang out. Again, more in identity enmeshment into the organization.
I don't think it's that black and white. And I think it really depends on the company, how many people work there, what the culture is, and what the people are like, and what the job is. So sure. I don't think there's like a hard and fast rule to that. I think if you're talking about most corporate settings, no, I don't think they're helpful in that way. Do I think getting together with people and getting to know them better and like, does that ultimately help you work better together? Like sometimes I think the more important interactions are actually the smaller ones that you have on a day to day, like on the way to the bathroom or, you know, while you're waiting for other people to get on a Zoom call and things like that. I think those are actually extremely important. And that's a whole other conversation I have with people about post-COVID and working from home and things like that. But, you know, you want to give people opportunities to get together and to know each other, but you don't want them to feel forced into it. And like, you know, like, for example, you're talking about kids, right? It's like, well, now I'm not going to make bedtime and my wife doesn't come home till 7 for her job. So now I'm going to have, you know, it's like stressful also to do that. And so I'm not saying don't have people do things outside the office. I just think that there's a careful way to do that. And it really depends on the culture of your company, and listening to employees and what they actually want is the best way to do that. And, you know, the best way, you know, I get why people do these team building exercises, right? Because completing a problem together builds camaraderie. Like I like we know that, but
trust
sort
pulse,
of, right?
Everything. Trust pulse fixes everything.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I like cringe when I think about a trust pulse. But obviously the stranger's not going to let me fall to the ground, but like that doesn't make me actually trust them anymore. It just makes us all like do the social construct that we're supposed to do. And that's kind of my point, you know?
Right.
And so you have to, if you're providing opportunities for people to be genuine and doing things that, you know, they're interested in doing, like for example, what you're doing with your company, right? Those managers are probably, it sounds like they're pretty excited about that. But she might also be stressed because now does she lose out on the PTO day, and like does her job now get harder because everyone's meeting without her, and mm-hmm. like you know she's new and she wants to do a good job, you know, so it's a very complicated situation, and I think people should just be aware of those dynamics and kind of try to come up with things that work for their employees, because as you know, like everybody needs to be managed differently, which is a real problem because
absolutely
there's a lot of people who have to make things happen. So you know, again, I think also the more you can know about people and the more you can know about all, you know, the better decisions you can make to actually achieve those goals of camaraderie.
That's right. So I'll sum up with a couple of ideas that this has sparked in me that we have talked about in the past on the podcast. But I think Dr. Koretz has hit some of the key items, which is that we manage humans, and humans are more than their work identity. And we don't necessarily manage them. We lead them, and we are their friends, and we're part of their lives. And them being, at times, more emotionally resilient outside of their careers, having a life outside of it is a good thing. For you actually listening, work will be bad sometimes. And some of us thrive on the harder times, and some of us get real antsy when everything's going fine. But whatever it is about your job, your career, your business, personally, I often feel the antsiest when I feel like things are going fine. And that's when I have my identity crisis. I'm not needed, right?
Mm.
And that's when I start looking around. Am I doing anything important in my life? Because everything's going fine. Heavens. Hmm?
Can I interrupt about that really quickly?
Yeah.
It's so interesting you say that, because for me, I feel the opposite, because I feel really good when I've hired people that are better than me to do things.
Absolutely.
And then I have these... Only certain ways am I needed, and I'm okay with that because I want it to run so well, and I know I can't do all the things the best that I can. So it's so funny that you say that, because to me, I'm
that
like,
is the business owner absolutely correct thing. And I am a person who literally is a hiring and building skills of other people. When everything's going great in my company, it means I've done a great job.
Right.
And I've got great people. They're reliable, and they know, and systems are going well. The clients love us, and that's the time often where I am psychologically least comfortable. Like, really, I started working when I was 13 and started this company when I was 22. When things are the same for 3 weeks in a row and no one's broken, I start looking for things to break. I know that. It's something I've dealt with. And 7 or 8 years ago in my company, I really did. It was going great. And I was like, well, let's do 10 more things then, right?
Right.
And it took a while to learn that about myself. It's something that you have to recognize as a danger, whatever those pieces are. For some people, when things are very chaotic and changing very quickly and we have to react and there's a lot of pressure, you may go, why am I working this hard, or why am I those? But for whatever reason, my personal anecdote is my wife knows that I'm get antsy and more likely to snap at the dog when 3 days have gone and everything's just gone fine. Yeah. But we've worked together every day since we were 16, so she knows me pretty well. I would say this: leadership, people, companies, it's all the same thing, and it's all complicated. And I think Dr. Koretz hits on, if you've listened to this podcast all the way through, the answer is it depends, and moderation, and there is no answer. And when someone says, implement this 4-step plan and all of your staff will have well-balanced, healthy lives and stay with you forever, they're lying. It takes what you can serve in this role is in the role of a leader, both in your own life, showing that it's okay to have a life outside of work, and also in talking with your direct reports on that one-on-one level. The idea is that the people who work for you, the way you treat them, is the way they'll treat their subordinates and on. And that's how it scales throughout. If you're in a position where you have 15 direct reports, it's nearly impossible to know them well enough to lead them. Most companies, as listen back a few episodes, a span of control of 7 people is a full-time gig by a huge degree. And the answer is because if you do it right, you know your people, you adjust to their circumstances, you lead them, help them develop, that's a full-time gig. And it'll give you a lot better output than 15 people poorly managed. So some really cool stuff. And Dr. Koretz, I appreciate you giving us the nuance. I really do. It's refreshing, because a lot of times people have a book to sell and a 5-step process. So
right.
I appreciate you saying, hey, complicated. Life is complicated and messy, and we got to do what we can with it.
Thank you.
For people to find more about you, where would they go check you out?
Our website has absolutely everything about, you know, our media. We have a couple of really interesting free tools on there, like a burnout calculator and a values navigator, which is actually now an app. So that's pretty cool. Yeah. So just more about what we do and things like that. So it's azimuthpsych.com, impossible to spell, A-Z-I-M-U-T-H psych.com. And we're just, everything is there.
Awesome. What is azimuth? To wrap it up, how'd you come up with this name?
Yes. I love the meaning so much, but it is not a great one to sort of have to spell over the phone, you know, on podcasts and things. It was a navigational tool that people used to use, obviously, before GPS and things. It's sort of like a mathematical calculation between where you are and where you want to be. So if you're over here and the North Star is that way and you want to be towards the North Star, the difference between the two is an azimuth.
I love it.
Thanks.
Great. Yep. Maybe my company was Poplar Insurance because we were on Poplar Avenue and I couldn't use my last name because no one would be able to spell it. I like your story better.
Well, there's a real key to picking something people can pronounce and spell. So
yeah, it goes both ways. Well, thank you again, Doctor. I appreciate you being on the People Processes podcast. For those of you listening, please like, subscribe, drop your comments below. We will forward on any direct questions, of course. And you can find Dr. Koretz at azimuthpsych.com, A-Z-I-M-U-T-H, psych.com. It'll be down in the description below. And if we can be of any help, please feel free to reach out. You can reach me at peopleprocesses.com. We do offer a 30-minute free consultation, any U.S.-based business owner with more than 10 employees. And we look forward to hearing from you all and your comments and ideas. If you're listening and go, this woman crazy, I want to hear it. I think she's been incredibly nuanced in her responses and ideas, honestly, in a surprising way, because as longtime listeners may have heard me really grill on people who are on the work-life balance train. I was afraid that's where we were going to go based on kind of the bio. And it's been a breath of fresh air. So I appreciate your time, Dr. Koretz.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much.